KZZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Russia says don't speculate about what caused the crash of an Azerbaijan Airlines jet in Kazakhstan. The official line, the plane flew into birds, but Andrew Nicholson, who advises airlines flying in the region, pointed to photographs of wreckage showing damage consistent with surface-to-air fire.
There were no scuffs or bumps or dents that would also indicate, you know, aircraft or birds hitting the aircraft fuselage. And also the direction of the shrapnel, which looks like it's coming from below.
Perhaps best known for his role in the 2017 movie Baby Driver, now 16-year-old actor Hudson Meek was killed last week falling out of a moving vehicle in the Birmingham suburb of Vestavia Hills, Alabama. In Kissimmee, Florida, police say Brianna Alvalo didn't like the $2 tip the woman gave her for a $33 bill. Investigators say Alvalo returned with an accomplice and stabbed the woman, who's now hospitalized.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's the Bucks and the Brooklyn Nets tonight at Fiserv Forum. Chris Middleton making progress, scoring 21 points in their win over the Bulls as he comes back from ankle surgery. Doc Rivers.
It's just going to take them time. These minutes have been fantastic for them. To keep them under 25 in the last two games when we have Dame and Giannis out and still keep Chris under 25, that's huge for us.
NFL, the Packers getting ready to play the Vikings Sunday in Minnesota. Wide receiver Christian Watson talked about that bruised knee injury he suffered Monday night on a 14-yard end run against the Saints.
It was just an awkward fall. I went to the ground and then the DB just kind of fell into my legs and just kind of felt something with the knee. I mean, it definitely hurt right away, but I mean, it felt like it was good enough to go back in. So I went back in and it was feeling all right. But I mean, it just kind of was just lingering a little bit and I just couldn't play the type of football I wanted to play. So just had to shut it down.
That's the Packers' Christian Watson. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. A viewer reached out, asked what the most concerning things to come are going to be. What is it that's on my mind? What is it that I'm worried about? What will Trump and the administration, Doge Boy and his clan, our CEO, billionaire government, what will they do? What do I think, the positives, the negatives? And I'm like, you know, I don't think I have enough time to respond to everything that's bothering me in this email. That is kind of why I have this show. And I said, hey, maybe pick one area, one thing of interest to you, and maybe I can help. And he said that, you know, he was a retired operating engineer. Labor was an important issue to him because he had spent his entire life as a union member. His retiree group, lifetime retiree union members, who all voted for Trump, evidently. And what he's looking for is things to be paying attention to attempt to educate his retiree group. And this is the model. This is what I keep talking about. The solutions will be in the suffering caused by their savagery. So as they're doing things through this next administration that are going to harm people, you kind of have to throw it in their face a little bit, going, hey, you voted for this guy. This is what he did. This is what would have made your life worse. What's going to make your kids' life worse. What's going to make your grandchildren's life worse. Maybe we don't do this. Maybe we undo this damage. And as I said, look, from a labor perspective, I am quite concerned about who he's going to appoint as the general counsel of the NLRB. For me as a labor guy, that's my number one area. There's a ton of other stuff. Everything that he's going to do to the federal workforce, that is a huge thing as well. The fact that we're going to overturn collective bargaining at the federal level, the fact that we're going to make all those people now at-will employees, and that could trickle down to everyone else, that's a problem for me. But there are some things that the Biden NLRB did that I fear immediately they overturn, the joint employer rule being one of them. This idea that, and I specifically look at the Amazons, the FedExes, companies that you see the face of the company in people who don't actually work for the company. When that person comes and delivers that package with the A and the Z and the smiley thing or whatever that is. That person doesn't actually work for Amazon. They work for a third-party contractor, or they're a gig worker, or they're someone who just, you know, got in their car and decided, hey, I'm going to go deliver packages today. I think once they overturn that joint employer rule, which would have helped to organize places like Amazon, that's going to be a huge setback. And look, we have the past to look to. The Trump administration did it. Immediately when they took office the first time around. There is no reason that I believe that he's not going to do it again. I look at some of the decisions that have come out of the NLRB, the CMEX decision, for instance, which is something that I've been talking about for years. My grandparents' generation didn't get subjected to long, drawn-out election campaigns. They signed cards, and they immediately started bargaining. And if they didn't get bargaining, they went right to the picket line. There was no secret election. There was no captive audience meetings. There were no following people around. There was none of that. There was a group of workers saying, we demand our rights, and we're going to bargain right freaking now. And this is where Jennifer Abruzzo and the Biden NLRB was moving back toward. When we had 33-35% of the workforce unionized, and I would argue we could get there again because I think that's the natural rate of organizing. The problem is, well, the laws are so stacked against workers. The power, the pendulum has swung so far to the side of employers that they're able to harass and intimidate and break the law without any real consequence. So this CMEX decision said, look, we're going to set the rules the way that used to be. You can recognize the union when they give you the card, say, we've got the majority. You can recognize it, start bargaining. The company and the union can come together and come up with a great plan, a great deal. And they can both move forward in a positive way. Or if you don't think the union has the support that they say they do, you can file for a prompt election if the union hasn't already done it. Great. You still get to keep your election. But here's the caveat. If the employer commits unfair labor practices, if they do what, like, say, Amazon did in Alabama, well, that election's set aside and you start bargaining. There are no rerun elections. There's no, oh, oops, sorry, I won't do it again. I'll post a notice. No, you go right to bargaining. And for me, that seems rational and reasonable. Understand, as soon as the Trump NLRB... the general counsel, whoever he appoints, probably Peter Robb, they'll bring him back because he was fired by Biden. As soon as that happens, that's flipped on its head. That's no longer going to be the rule of the law of the land. Also, just recently, the NLRB banned mandatory anti-union captive audience meetings. This is a massive precedent-setting rule that focused right at Amazon and others like them. That will be overturned immediately once the Republicans take back the National Labor Relations Board. Understand, they are going to undo what little progress was done during the Biden years. They are going to swing the pendulum even further to the side of corporate interests. And for my retiree friends, the world that we are now in is not the world that you started working in. It is much more hostile to workers organizing. It is much more hostile to workers who are unionized. It is much more hostile to organized labor. and the reason that you're benefiting from the health care that you get in retirement, the pension you get, the wages you earned over the years, the working conditions you enjoyed, all of that is under attack again. Because the deregulation folks are back in town. And with the Chevron decision on their side, the government can't oversee anything, the constant assaults of the administrative state, all of that stuff under attack. Well, those things are, well, for your children and grandchildren, also under attack. So for me, this is where my focus is, not my sole focus. Clearly, there's a lot of bad going to happen. But if you needed to pick one little sliver of my concern world, this is it. And it should concern all working people because it's going to trickle down. This, unlike the tax code, this will trickle down. Terrible trickles down. What's that saying about, you know, stuff rolling downhill? You know what that is? Well, we're at the bottom of the hill and we're about ready to catch it right in the face. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dave Jamieson, labor reporter at Huffington Post, going to be here to share some of his thoughts on what he's paying attention to. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a new year, a new administration on the horizon. Lots of changes in Washington, D.C. And what's that going to mean? What's it going to mean for organized labor? What's going to mean for workers across the country? You know, we talked about Project 2025 extensively during the campaign. What's it going to mean now that they're actively talking about, yeah, that's kind of our plan. What's it going to mean for workers and people across the country? Well, here to share some thoughts on what it could look like and what he's looking for, I've asked my good friend Dave Jamieson to come share some thoughts. Dave's a labor reporter over at Huffington Post. You can check out his work over at HuffPost.com. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So, we're heading to a new old kind of administration. What are we expecting? What are we expecting in the new Trump administration?
So look, there's a lot of unknowns right now. I do think generally we should expect very similar policies on the labor front to the first Trump administration, which was, you know, generally like very, very anti-union, hostile to collective bargaining, both within the federal sector where Trump managed the federal workforce. They basically tried to break the federal unions, but also for, you know, private sector workers and the way he shaped the National Labor Relations Board. I'd say one sort of like curveball so far is this like pretty moderate pick for labor secretary. But look, the reality is, labor secretary doesn't do much oversight of unions. They don't impact collective bargaining the way that the labor board does. And, you know, frankly, a labor secretary can be sidelined pretty easily by an administration.
Sure.
If they want to do that. So I think a lot remains to be seen on if she gets confirmed, you know, what she will look like, Lori Chavez de Reamer at the Labor Department. But, there's a lot we don't know what they're going to do with the NLRB yet. And, I do have some thoughts on what we might see go down there.
Yeah. No, look, I give Teamsters President Sean O'Brien all the credit for former Representative Lori Chavez Dreamer being named this. I believe this is the payback from Trump for what happened during the campaign, the non-endorsement, and I would argue tacit endorsement of Trump by O'Brien in the IBT. So this is what I think he's got for it. As I said a while ago, though, I think that's not going to be great because I think a lot of the bad stuff still going to happen regardless of this pick. And some of that bad stuff, you know, you go down through the list of the big one for the Teamsters is the joint employer rule. If that goes by the wayside, as it did during the first Trump administration, that's a huge hit to the IBT.
Yeah, I think if you're cynical, you could look at the choice of Chavez Dreamer, who is pro-union, who endorsed the PRO Act. She was one of, I think, three Republicans in the House who did that. So really a best case scenario, yep. I would say.
Absolutely. Best choice by the worst person.
For labor. However, if you're cynical, you could think of it as something that could run cover for, you know, much more damaging picks to come. You know, she could be window dressing for, you know, a Republican rebranding as pro-labor while substantively they do very anti-union things. That's if you're cynical about such things.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because you know, I'm with you on that front, because I think Republicans have been trying to make overture in rhetoric, not policy, mind you, but in rhetoric to court organized labor, because there are a lot of union voters who vote for Republicans. And I think, you know, O'Brien has tapped into a little bit of that. Do you see that there's a possibility? Because I've had people tell me that Sean O'Brien believes that the Republicans, that Donald Trump and the Republicans are going to pass the PRO Act or some version of. Do you see any possibility of that happening?
I do not see them passing the PRO Act. Look, I think you got to look at Lori Chavez Dreamer in sort of, I think it's wrong to look at her through this lens of like this, the new pro worker Republican Party. She's more like an old school, I think old school labor friendly Republican, like we've seen in the East, you know, these guys, you know, Brian Fitzpatrick in New Jersey, bunch of, you know, guys in there are guys like that in Pennsylvania. I kind of see her more along those lines, the whole sort of like Josh Hawley, J.D. Vance, you know, we are pro-worker, we need to pivot the party. That stuff so far is just rhetoric. None of them have really, you know, supported the legislation that would, you know, help bolster the labor movement. So I think, you know, Chavez Dreamer, she's a test case in a couple ways. One is like, will the Senate approve her, right? Because already I had run around the Hill asking senators about her, and they have real reservations because she supported the PRO Act. Well, what's that going to say if they sink Trump's pick because she's too union friendly? Two, the test is if she does get through, like, what will they actually do at the Labor Department? Will it be, you know, more worker friendly? Will they be aggressive in OSHA and wage and hour enforcement? Or will it be more like a standard Republican administration where they pull back on all that stuff and really just try to like crank up regulation of unions and union spending?
No, well, and the big one for me is the NLRB, obviously, because I think the current, you know, general counsel of the NLRB is fabulous. I think some of the decisions that have come out have been fantastic. I look at the return to the Joy Silk doctrine and organizing the way my grandparents were able to, where you sign a card, you don't have to go through long, lengthy, you know, harassing, intimidating election campaigns, speeding up those campaigns when necessary. And also the CMIX decision, I think that's a huge thing that I think immediately goes by the wayside during this administration.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the NLRB, I frankly, if Trump put forward union-friendly or even moderate members as opposed to like standard management bar people, I would be pretty shocked. I do not expect a sort of a Chavez Dreamer type thing to happen at the board. And really, I think we could see some pretty extreme scenarios play out. One being Trump simply firing Democratic board members. That's something a lot of people are concerned about right now. Now, he is going to fire Jennifer Abruzzo immediately. I think there's like very little question about that. probably on day one, if not day one, only because they were busy doing other stuff.
No, I think day one only. I think day one only because Biden fired his his guy Peter Robb, who was somewhat instrumental in firing the Patco workers in 81. To tell you what his pedigree is. So I assume you're right. I assume that that's going to happen. You know, probably at 4:59 instead of 5 o'clock on day one.
Yeah, but there's a separate issue of firing sitting board members who you are supposed to have, you need cause to do that, or it needs to have been some kind of, failure of duties on their parts. But, the Trump administration may want to challenge that the removal powers doctrine there. It's sort of this constitutional fight they might be itching to have. And now, Lauren McFerrin, the Democratic chair at the board right now, is up for... They might vote on her reconfirmation for her as early
soon.
As today.
Right.
And if she does, if they push her through, that would keep a Democratic board there for almost a couple more years. And that could, that could prompt the Trump administration to say, well, hell with it. Let's just fire the whole board and install a new one. And you're going to have a big legal fight over that.
No, I fully expect that to happen. And I fully expect, our Supreme Court to go in very weird ways, and the court system as a whole, and which brings me to the Supreme Court. The NLRA is making its way through as Doge Boy and Bezos and that crowd are seeking to overturn parts of the National Labor Relations Act. Are you expecting any more on that front, or any thoughts, any news for us?
Yeah, that case. I mean, that case is working its way up. We don't know when it'll get to SCOTUS, but it's very likely going to get there at some point. And, I talked to a lot of legal experts about it and former board members about how this could play out. And just like a lot of disturbing unknowns, when it reaches the Supreme Court, they could sort of tailor a decision that is bad the way labor advocates see the board, maybe like tightening up the remedies that are available to workers when they're like illegally fired. There are ways they might be able to adjust things to like keep functioning. But on the other extreme end, with like a really aggressive ruling that like really gets at the whole administrative law judge system, they could kind of blow up the board, frankly, and like sort of throw it in a dysfunction. And I think there'd be a lot of unknowns about, the board being able to carry out its like basic duties and administer cases, and it would be really, it could be devastating for organizing campaigns, I think, especially like younger ones. When you talk about some like newer independent union that doesn't have a lot of firepower, and if they're like filing charges and bringing cases and they just kind of sit there as the board is like in dysfunction, that's really bad news for those campaigns.
Right, but the whole NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, isn't going to get tossed. I would argue just the parts that are beneficial to workers. Anything that hamstrings or handcuffs workers, I think, will remain fully enforceable and right there front and center. Because I have friends, Dave, who say, you know what, screw it, blow the whole thing up, and let's go back to the militancy of the past, which I don't think we're that country. But it's an interesting thought process.
Yeah, and honestly, I've wondered a lot about, it's lawyers at Morgan Lewis who've been, pushing these cases, and I kind of wonder what the end game is there for them, because the reality is this current system, as we know, like it works pretty well for employers who hate unions,
yep.
Right? The labor law is like generally broken. The cases sit there forever. The company's told to rehire you 7 years after you were fired and you've like moved across the country and are in another job. So, if I were these companies, the employers, I'd kind of wonder about wanting to blow up this system that, has not, engendered a lot of union organizing. Because there's a lot of unknowns, right? And I have talked to people who are like, well, if they're going to break things down, then why not? Well, then we'll do secondary boycotts and do illegal strikes. What are they going to do? And so I think it could like usher in a lot, quite a bit more chaos and discontent.
Yeah, I mean, look, we got the NLRA, and I've argued over the years that it was a peace treaty because my grandparents' generation were literally ripping this country apart.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, blood was shed. People forget that.
Yeah.
And obviously, I don't think Trader Joe's wants to return to that.
I don't either. But you know,
maybe also, they do. Who knows?
You know, who knows? Clearly, who knows? Because you know, we've got someone like Doge Boy. Elon Musk saying there's going to be pain. I think they want to cause a recession. I think they want a massive recession. But you know, I got this guy out here saying we need to be cutting all of these things and labor front and center on his wish list of things to destroy. Any thoughts on Doge and Musk's wet dream?
Yeah, Doge is it's not a real agency, first off, right? This is an advisory committee, and there's been ones like it. I think probably none of them have had like sort of the big flashy rollout that this one had, and you know, steering the bureaucracy in another direction and making big cuts is actually like really hard. So I'm trying to like have some skepticism about their goals and what they think they're going to accomplish. All that said, I think they're going to like the administration in general is going to be very, very aggressive in trying to gut protections for federal employees and really just taking an axe to federal sector collective bargaining. I mean, I think the unions are prepping for this, and they really, when I talk to them, I sense that you know, a worst case scenario, you know, that they're preparing for, where basically we're not just talking about like chipping away at telework. We're talking about trying to eliminate collective bargaining at certain agencies. And there's a sense that even some of the stuff that might not fly legally, that they might just try to do it. You know, because why not? And we'll see you in court and we can fight over it for 2 years. But I do think I take them at their word when they say they really want to, attack the federal workforce.
Right. No, we talked a lot about during the campaign. We talked a lot about Trump's want to use Schedule F to fire, you know, all of these quote unquote bureaucrats and replace them with good loyalists. We know the Heritage Foundation and Project 2025 vetted a whole bunch of sycophants to be able to fill these positions. So it looks like from the outside, sitting here, listening to what they say, watching what they're doing, that they are going to try and go in and you know, gut the civil service workforce and put in, you know, good loyalists who are going to do what dear leader wants them to do.
Yeah, I think that's right. And right now, you know, we're hearing people are trying to shuffle jobs or the way they're categorized because they feel like they're on some bubble where they're civil servants now, but in a few months, are they going to be essentially a political appointee who can be fired? And, you know, hearing stuff about people, scrubbing their social media for anything that the Trump administration might not like. And, you know, not a great way to be going into work every day.
Yeah, no, look, I've been talking about China and I've been talking about our trade deficits and our trade policies and all this. And I've been getting beat up because, you know, look, I still think this is one of the best places on the planet to live. And I think China does cheat on trade and all this stuff. And I've been getting beat up by going, you know, well, our system is bad and all this stuff's happened. So as we lay this out and we talk about, you know, we now have a guy who says he's going to be dictator on day one. He's going to go in and, you know, basically flaunt all the rules in front of us and do all of these horrible things. It kind of gets harder to make that argument that we're all that much better than a lot of other places.
Yeah, and look, a lot of this stuff they talked about doing last time, but I think it's a little different now. You know, someone was describing 2016, you know, Trump being the dog that caught the car, yep. You know, and they came in and they didn't really have the best game plan.
They've been planning.
And they were kind of throwing whatever they had at the wall.
Yep.
But now they got more of a game plan. And, you know, you look at the way the judiciary has shifted because of Trump's first term, where you got, you know, judiciary right up to the Supreme Court that's like pretty on board with gutting the administrative state. And so I think there's a lot more. They have a lot more advantages this time around.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you. In the new year with the new administration, what are you going to be looking at? What's your interest focus? Everyone's got their thing. What's yours?
I'm going to be doing a lot on the federal workforce and the what Trump is trying to do with it. I think it's going to be one of the major storylines of the administration. And like I said, I'm skeptical of a lot of things, but I, you know, I take them at their word when they say that they want to gut job protections. And I think we're going to see probably quite a bit of turmoil at a lot of agencies. We're going to see them trying to push people out. We're going to see them trying to push people across the country to move from Washington, wherever. And so I think it's going to be kind of one of the big storylines of Trump 2.0 is how they try to change the federal government.
And I see a lot of privatization. I see a lot of that, just my view. But Dave, as always, great stuff. Keep up the amazing work. Hope folks will check out your work over at HuffPost. But Dave Jabinson, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. How bad do you think it's going to be for organized labor? How bad do you think it's going to be for workers? That's the question. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Dense fog advisory for low visibilities through tomorrow morning. Cloudy, foggy, drizzle, and lows in the mid-30s tonight. Rain developing for tomorrow and tomorrow night. Highs in the low 40s. Cloudy with rain and snow shower Saturday. High upper 30s. Right now it's 33.
Earl Ingram.
Chuck from East Troy. Good morning to you, Chuck. You say what?
I have a bone to pick with you. Since my wife discovered Civic Media 2 years ago, we are addicted to Civic Media, and you are one of the ringleaders. So anyway, I just want to thank you. Have a good day.
Hey, Chuck, man, thank you very much for the call. Tell your wife I said thank you, and it's an honor and a privilege.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So that is the question. What happens if the Supreme Court rules the NLRA unconstitutional, the National Labor Relations Act? What happens? You know, just like, you know, I asked what would things look like if the NLRA was gutted to Dave Jabinson. And Dave reminded us, you know, there was bloodshed in the streets. There were not good things that went on. And that could potentially happen again. And my friend Sean Rickman's got a piece over at In These Times titled Sabotage as a Tool of Solidarity. And in there he writes that union activists must contemplate a potential future in which no union activity is protected by law. And therefore, all tactics from sit-down strikes to secondary boycotts to, yes, sabotage are on the table and morally justified. Here to share some thoughts on that statement, I've asked my good friend Sean Rickman to come talk with us. Sean's a contributing writer over at In These Times. He's also the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So morally justified?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, the bosses will throw everything that they've got at us, including, as was alluded to, bloodshed. And so if you're fighting for your right, your actual right to work, your actual right to put a roof over your head and provide for your family, you gotta fight with what you've got. And how you can, and I think a lot of us are saying, well, we have to look at what union organizing looked like prior to 1935.
And look, I've talked about it, and my grandparents, when they came back from fighting World War II and fighting fascism overseas, they came home and fought it on the shop floor, and it was not Mother May I, it wasn't nice and clean and prim and proper. There were violent strikes. There was bloodshed in the streets. There was literally this country being torn apart. And I've often said the NLRA was that peace treaty that said, hey, how about we don't?
It was exactly a peace treaty. It brought a structure and a process to recognition. And in its original form, it was actually a very radical document, because it basically said it is the policy of the federal government to encourage the practice of collective bargaining. And it compelled employers to recognize and bargain in good faith with unions. And there was no nonsense about elections and majority votes or whatever. It was basically wherever workers presented themselves as you know, hey, we are a union, two or more of us, we are a union. The employer had to negotiate, had to recognize them, and had to deal with them. And you know, there was a period there before the Supreme Court, what was seen at the time as the most conservative Supreme Court, basically allowed the NLRA to stand in the 1937 decision. For a 2-year period there, most employers just didn't respect the law. They ignored it. They're like, well, let's wait and see what happens with the Supreme Court. And some employers like Republic Steel and some of the other smaller, relative to the U.S. Steel, smaller steel employers machine gunned their workers. Once the Supreme Court ruled that that the NLRA was constitutional, you had millions of workers getting recognized in their unions. And you had employers all over the place recognizing unions and bargaining them. Large employers that set the tone for the rest of industry, General Motors, U.S. Steel, as I said. And then with that process set in place, the Supreme Court started taking away almost as quickly. So there's a decision in, I want to say 1938, where they took away protections for sit-down strikes. Now, I want to be clear here. They didn't, and this is sort of the thinking we have to have. They didn't make sit-down strikes illegal. Sit-down strikes are already illegal. You're trespassing, you know, you're right. Occupying somebody else's property. You're committing all kinds of property laws. But what the NLRA said, if the Supreme Court hadn't started gutting it, was, well, when you get out of jail, you're entitled to go back to your job because engaging in union activity is
protected.
When the Supreme Court took away protections for union activity in which other crimes were committed, so we're not going to protect you if it was for union purposes. So that took sabotage off the table. That just took sit-down strikes off the table. And for the most part, union leaders at the time were fine with that because the process was working. We still weren't even having a lot of union elections. Most union recognitions were either voluntary or they were card check certifications. So basically it was union organizer walks up to the factory gates, hands out the cards, workers come back with cards representing a majority of workers, file with the NLRB, you recognize you're at the table bargaining.
Yep.
That was working, so unions saw no need to continue with, you know, much more dangerous, much more higher stakes tactics like the sit-downs. And like sabotage. But now that there isn't that fair process anymore, now that it is win by hook or by crook, and that you have employers that will return to spying, the Pinkertons never really went away. A company still is engaged in the union busting business, and they will come out and bring their name forward. Blacklists, other agreements, non-compete clauses, et cetera, et cetera. Once you're fighting that sort of stuff, then that's when I say, you know, any tactic that you can is morally justified, with the caveat of nothing that endangers human life. We're talking about machines, buildings, doorways, you know, roadways, things like that.
Well, we just saw a Supreme Court case on this very thing, out in Seattle, the Glacier Cement Company. Northwest Glacier, they just ruled that the union's responsible for paying for all of the cement that evidently wasn't used because the company wasn't prepared for the workers going on strike. So we've gone to the point where it's not even really sabotage. You're paying for just bad management at this point. That's how far the pendulum has swung.
Bad management, sabotage, I call them the same thing. And if I heard of any workers intentionally sabotaging, I would point the finger at, well, that was just bad management, obviously. Because morale is on management at the end of the day, anyway.
Correct.
But that's a good point, that any tactic may be morally justified, but the law doesn't go away. So losing the NLRA, losing the NLRB, means that no union action is protected, which puts them all on equal footing, which means you can sign a union card, you could get fired.
Right. You could wear a button.
Meaning you could get fired. So once it's at that level, then what is now our sort of, you know, what most organizers will do, will counsel, you know, sort of the safer road, ways to protect yourself, you know, will tell you when to wear the union button, when not to, et cetera, et cetera. That all goes out the window because you're vulnerable no matter what you do, which at which point, again, you know, some of the riskier tactics are worth putting on the table. But that doesn't mean employers can't sue you for the economic damages that you and your coworkers do in pursuing your union rights. That's where we're going. And you know, talk about bloodshed, we talk about violence. Most employer violence is done with lawyers these days.
Yeah, you know, they went from bullets to batons to briefcases. I've often said that's the path because I don't know that we're a society in this moment that is that all that militant yet. If the NLRA were to go away, would we accept it is the question I come back to. Now, look, I know there are a lot of people who are going to argue, yeah, we have pockets of militancy, but we're not my grandparents' generation. I just don't think so. I don't think we're that society. Or do you disagree?
Well, we have no choice but to accept it. What are you going to do? There's no place to bring the union cards to ask for a fair election. That goes out the window. That we're going to have to accept. There is definitely an educational process that has to take place among workers. And you know, our problems are even deeper than USEX. If you think about it, the vast majority of workplaces in America have never been touched by a union.
Right.
You know, forget about places where there is a union, but, you know, the workers might think of it as that business agent who comes around once a month and hands out stickers and buttons or whatever. Most places have never touched a union. Most workers have never really considered what collective action looks like, what you and me, you know, taking a complaint to the boss or, you know, a bunch of us standing up at the end of the shift and advocating on behalf of our coworker who needs to take tomorrow off for a parent-teacher conference or whatever. Most workers haven't considered that. There is going to be a little bit of trial and error. And I'm hoping for experimentation. I'm hoping, you know, I'm addressing my articles a little bit more to that vast majority of workers that are untouched by unions to start getting creative about, you know, what power in your workplace could look like. Absent full, you know, the majority of us have decided, almost all of us are in the union, because most places aren't going to get to that. But how does a militant minority get its point across? And that's where folks need to be talking to each other now.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, I have friends who are excited about the fact that the NLRA could go by the wayside, and we can really, you know, get back to, you know, marching in the streets and the kind of militancy that they imagine in their head. And you know, I'm hoping they're right. I'm hoping that, you know, that could be the future. But if that's the future, why can't it be the now?
Well, that hopefully that those conversations are taking place. I write about this in my book. Back when the Change to Win groups had not yet left the AFL-CIO, and there was a debate about, you know, well, organize or die didn't quite work out. We're not organizing a million workers a year. What do we do differently? How do we convince SEIU and Unite Here and the Teamsters not to leave? And the American Federation of Teachers of all unions put out a proposal that said, well, we got to break the law. we have to engage in secondary boycotts. And in order to do that, what we need to do is we need to seed startup unions. We need brand new unions that don't have a fancy office building down the street from the White House. They don't have any money. They don't have a bank account. They don't have millions of dollars they can be sued for. And we need to figure out ways to legally protect as much as possible the individual workers that are going to step up as leaders for these new startup unions. So it's one thing to potentially use your union's office. It's another thing if they figure out a way to come after you and your house and your family's home. So we got to figure out ways to protect them as much as possible. But let's create startup unions to organize in these areas of the economy where there really is no union. And at the time, and still, we're talking about, you know, Amazon, we're talking about Walmart fulfillment centers. And cut them loose. And then, you know, let's be more willing to engage in secondary activity. So hopefully these conversations are starting to begin now, because we're about 16 months away from losing the NLRB. And as I pointed to, some of the more obvious opportunities that we do have is the fact that we have unions that are responsible for making deliveries to retail stores, to distribution centers, to private homes, that could interrupt that flow and refuse to deliver unfair products, refuse to pick up packages from employers that are fighting their union. The grocery store workers, the UFCW, stand out as a union with tremendous potential, so far unrealized power. If we just started intervening in what products are those members are willing to put on the shelves, depending on how Oreo is treating its employees.
No, it's an excellent point. Now, as you just said a second ago, you expect the NLRB to go away in 16 months. What do unions do once that happens? I know I look at, a state like Illinois passed the Worker Protection Act 2 years ago, I believe it was. Is that the mission, as you point out? Is this a state's right thing? What do you think?
I think it does turn into a state's rights thing, and I think that most union leaders are going to be initially focused on how to get new state laws to replace it. And there's some history here. When the NLRA was passed in 1935, in order to get past the second most conservative Supreme Court in history, they needed a constitutional theory, and their constitutional theory was Congress has the authority to regulate commerce between the states. That's it. And I've written a lot about this in my book and other places about how conceptually that put unions on the back foot and in a defensive posture throughout, where we're in the courts having to defend our civil rights based upon their impact on commerce, and employers get to go in and defend their rights on First Amendment and other grounds. So, but because of that, interstate commerce was defined much more narrowly in 1935 than before the civil rights era, when the federal government started reaching into drugstore counters and other places against discrimination, eventually pulling other workplaces into the labor law. But hotels were not considered interstate commerce. Entirely within the boundaries of a state, everybody's inside of a state, there's no trade outside, it wasn't seen as interstate commerce. So states like New York and a lot of states where New Deal Democrats had power to pass laws created baby Wagner acts. And my next book is a history of a hotel workers union in New York. We always had a union. And when they finally got their contract in the 1930s, the Waldorf Astoria, the Plaza Hotel, all these places, those bargaining units were certified by a state labor relations board in a card check process that copied the NLRB to a lot of extent, but also was sort of a parallel system of governance. It still exists. That law is still on the books, and it basically says that workers that the NLRB does not consider to be statutory employees, therefore are not covered by the NLRB because federal law has a priority, preemption. So if you're not covered by the federal law, then you're covered by us.
Right.
So every unionist in New York, I think, is going to say, well, let's beef up that law. Let's revive it and let's take out some of that Taft-Hartley crap that might be that might have sneaked in there. And so New Jersey, Illinois, California, you can see those states going in a similar direction. Now, you go down that road and, it's good for protecting us from any major losses, from employers withdrawing recognition, tearing up contracts, things like that. And most union density is actually in those states anyway. It forecloses growth in the South and in all these other states where you're never going to get an NLRB type body passed. And you're putting yourself on the path. You're in Abraham Lincoln territory at that point. You are a house divided that cannot stand over the very same issues as the last time that happened.
So it sounds like we have an interesting future ahead. So what are you expecting coming out of this Trump administration? What are you expecting? What's the best case scenario or worst case scenario? What are you thinking?
The best case scenario is incompetence. If Trump remains as incompetent as he has been, then, you know, he keeps nominating rapists and drunks to various boards and they have to drop out, and the Republicans can never muster enough votes in the House to pass anything. So you only have sort of a slow decline. But the thing about the Supreme Court decision is if Kamala Harris was president, it would still happen.
It's still going to happen.
That's the logic that they have set into place by focusing so much on capturing the federal courts. And they captured the federal courts a long time ago, and Elon Musk and Amazon, the National Right to Work Foundation, they counted the votes. They know they've got it. They've been working for it for years, and they're hell bent on doing it. And they were going to do it regardless of who the president.
No, that's an excellent point. So, but, you know, last question, I guess, then, because this, you brought up Doge Boy. It's amazing to me that working people would look at this guy and think he's going to be any help whatsoever on any issue whatsoever. So I'm curious your thoughts on Doge and Musk's push to undermine labor law in this country even further.
I don't know. I guess some people love the taste of shoe leather. But no, he's also an idiot. And I mean, there's a long history of folks doing the same sort of thing as him. You know, it's not an official government entity. It's this little sandbox that he can go in, play over here, make recommendations, and get them lost. And speaking cynically, as much of an idiot as I think Donald Trump is, he is smart enough to know how to scapegoat somebody who is vying with him for ultimate power in this country. So Musk is out there, can make all of his grand statements, will fall on his face, and Trump will say it's all his fault, particularly when they come after Medicare and Medicaid and the Labor Act.
Yeah, no, because one of the first things I said, it's going to be interesting to see how quickly Trump throws Doge Boy under the bus and how that really fight, quick. How that fight then becomes the center of attention.
If they're still allied this time next year, I'd be amazed.
I'm right there with you, Sean. I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Okay, thank you.
Our good friend Sean Richmond. Make sure you check out his piece over at In These Times, Sabotage as a Tool of Solidarity. Also, make sure you check out his book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day that the United Mine Workers leader John L. Lewis wrote the AFL stating, "We disaffiliate." Lewis had had a stormy history with the American Federation of Labor. He was central to the 1935 split that soon led to the founding of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. By 1942, he led the United Mine Workers out of the CIO. Reasons included disagreements over labor's relationship to President Roosevelt and U.S. entry into World War II and the running of the CIO itself. For a brief time, the United Mine Workers reaffiliated with the AFL. But by the fall of 1947, Lewis found himself in fundamental disagreement with the Federation over its response to the recently passed Taft-Hartley Act. At the October AFL convention, the discussion centered on the signing of anti-communist affidavits as required by Taft-Hartley. Lewis was virtually alone in his refusal to comply with the act. He noted that the act would have been stillborn if labor leaders had stood tall and refused to sign the affidavits. Further, he said, quote, "This act is a trap, a pitfall for organizations of labor. This act was passed to oppress labor, to make difficult its current enterprises for collective bargaining, to make more difficult the securing of new members for this labor movement, without which our movement will become so possessed of inertia that there is no action and growth. In a labor movement where there is no growth, there is no security for its existence, because deterioration sets in and unions, like men, retrograde." Despite the split, the United Mine Workers would remain a powerful, independent union for more than 40 years. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So in a very fitting way to end the Democrats' rule of the U.S. Senate. And this is one of those things where, you know, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have been the thorn in the side of the Democratic Party for quite some time. Granted, gave them the majority, but only kind of to loosey them on every single issue that Democrats thought as a priority to reach the working class, things that were going to make life better. Sinema and Manchin dead set against two corporate Democrats. Yeah, they are what they are. And you know, when you elect corporate Democrats, this is what you're going to get. And understand, it's easy for me to beat up on Democrats, but Republicans were united in their opposition to this. I'm struggling with this moment because you had two Democrats who could have made life a little bit easier for working people in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, but chose, for whatever it is, whatever they got, whatever their rationale was, basically a screw job. For those who don't know, a woman named Lauren McFerrin, she was the chairman of the NLRB. Her term was up this year. They were trying to reconfirm her, so she'd have another 2 years, which meant that the Democrats would hold at least the NLRB for the first 2 years. So a lot of the really ugly, really bad stuff wasn't going to happen in the next 2 years. It would give a little window, a little breathing room. And, well, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin joined 47 Republicans to deadlock this nomination. Now, for all those people that say, you know, the Republicans want to be the party of working people, not one Republican voted to confirm this woman, who has been a very good chairperson. She's been fantastic, I think. But Roger Marshall, a Republican from Kansas, who Teamsters President Sean O'Brien often points to as one of the good ones, one of the good Republicans, he did the union's proud. He didn't vote. Yeah, he didn't vote. So a 49-49 deadlock with Roger Marshall could have been 50-49, could have shown his true concern for organized labor. Not so much. And this is where I keep coming back to. These votes matter. These votes are important. What they say yay and nay to, or what they don't show up for, kind of a big freaking deal. Now, this crucial procedural vote that could have cleared the way for McFerrin to her nomination to be confirmed and ensuring this could happen wasn't really that heavy of a lift. But for some reason, you had Manchin and Sinema, who, well, you know. And the worst part about it is you look at Manchin. Manchin made them wait 90 minutes for him to vote no. So this is kind of almost like a Democratic screw you, like John McCain did, only Manchin didn't do the dance whatever to get attention. Now, Sinema, she was the first of the two to vote no, obviously, and she didn't do her dippy-do either. So what does this mean? Well, it means what we've been talking about this hour. It means that the National Labor Relations Board will swing its power to whoever Trump chooses. And understand, I think McFerrin probably would have been fired anyway. I do think, as we've talked about earlier, that Trump will do what he's already told us he's going to do. He is going to overreach in every area possible. And this was going to be part of that. So will Jennifer Brusseau be fired on day one? Absolutely. Would they have gone after this? Absolutely. They are going to pack our government with loyalists and absolutists and sycophants and, you know, dear leader types. So get ready for the bad stuff. And, you know, as I've been saying, you know, we've been warned. We were told who they are. They told us who we are. We just didn't bother to listen. So out of all of this that's going to come, maybe the lessons will come with it. And maybe the positive, and I'm going to look at this as a positive. Maybe out of this suffering, some good stuff will come. Maybe the militancy of our grandparents' generation will return to our souls. Maybe the concept of solidarity will return to our hearts. Maybe direct action will become who we are again. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. A lot of people did their part this holiday to drive the consumer-driven U.S. economy.
The consumer is healthy, and that bodes well for where the state of the U.S. economy is right now.
Senior advisor Steve Sadov at MasterCard, which says total spending from November 1st through Christmas Eve rose 3.8%, blowing through the estimate of a 3.2% rise in sales.
You have a lower unemployment rate. You have consumers having wage growth. They were feeling reasonably good, and they were opening up their pocketbooks.
A federal judge in Detroit sentenced three leaders of a nationwide street gang to prison terms ranging from 60 to 70 years on their murder, drug trafficking, and RICO conspiracy convictions. Jennifer Crumley, mother of Oxford, Michigan high school massacre shooter Ethan Crumley, petitioning a judge to release her from prison while she appeals her involuntary manslaughter conviction. This is ABC News.